Welcome to Nexus 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode of Nexus 818 Podcast features the Montford Point Marines. After 144 years of exclusion due to segregation, approximately 20,000 African American men were admitted to the Marine Corps. For their valiant service to our nation, these Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in November of 2011. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out episode 27 from October the 4th of 2023 to learn about the background of the Montford Point Marines. I'm pleased to welcome to episode 37 the National Public Relations Officer for the Montford Point Marine Association. My guest tonight is retired Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant Joe Jeter III, a national leader in the Montford Point Marine Association. Welcome, Joe.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me, Doc.
Okay. In episode 27, I introduced the audience to the history of the Montford Point Marines. Tonight, I want to talk about the role of the Montford Point Marine Association and your involvement. So first, I want to talk a little bit about your background, because I think that provides the context for your commitment to the legacy of the Montford Point Marines.
Okay.
You're originally from Chicago, where you enlisted in the Marines.
Yeah.
You were first in your class at logistics school at Camp Pendleton, California.
Yes.
You served in all three Marine divisions. You served three tours of duty in Marine Division, three tours of duty in Marine Air Wings, three tours with Force Service Units, one tour with Marine Corps Recruit Depot, one tour as Depot Logistics Chief in San Diego, and one tour as the Air Station Equal Opportunity Advisor for the Station Commander at Marine Corps Station in Beaufort, South Carolina.
Wow, that's correct.
I know. And you're only 30, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's a very impressive background. So what prompted you to enlist in the Marines?
Well, what prompted me to enlist in the Marines was my best friend. I had to put a singular incident on there. I had an individual. His name was Tony. He was a year older than me. I had a little brother, but I never had an older brother to look up to. But Tony was like my older brother. And we did everything together, rode our bikes, bowled, did everything together. And when he enlisted in the Marine Corps, I didn't know he enlisted. So he was almost exactly a year older than me. So in December of 1975, he came home from boot camp and he came to my house and I opened up the door and he's standing there in a uniform. I'm like, Tony.
And you like that uniform, right?
I love that uniform. and it wasn't even a blues uniform. He was in a dress green uniform. But I was only 17 at the time, and he just looked good in the uniform. He was in shape when he left, but he looked better in shape. And the first thing I said to him is, if you could do it, I can do it. And he took me down to the recruiting office, the same one he enlisted from in my neighborhood, and put me in the delay entry program. So, because I was still in high school when he came home. And so he kind of coached me when to ship out. And he said, if you ship out in September, then 12 weeks of boot camp, you'll be home by Christmas. So he really sold the Marine Corps to me. And I literally followed his footsteps. I left for boot camp almost exactly a year after he did. And true to his statement, I was home by December 22nd. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure your parents were happy about that.
Well, my mother was, she had to sign me in. She was divorced from my dad. So I needed parental consent at 17. And Tony advised me to wait till I was 18 to go to boot camp. For some reason, they gave the 17-year-olds a hard time because their mother signed or their father had to sign them in. So I turned 18 on Friday, September 17th, 1976. And by Monday, I was in boot camp.
All right. So, I talked a lot about some of the accolades and interesting things from your background in Marines. Anything else you'd like to add about your military career and education?
Well, I tell you, when I first enlisted, it was no plan at all. I mean, I'm 18. I didn't have a plan to stay in for 20 years, and I didn't have this master plan. I simply wanted to get out of Chicago. It's just that simple. And my best friend offered me a path to do that. But after I got in the Marine Corps, even though it was still a little tough, nowhere near as tough as it was for the Montford Pointers, but the mid-70s was still a lot of social unrest in America, and that did not, the Marine Corps, the military was not exempt from that. So it was tough. You know, I was called names that weren't my on my birth certificate. But I thought once I got into the Fleet Marine Force, after I went to logistics school, and as you mentioned, I found logistics school pretty darn easy. I mean, it was mostly common sense to me. And they told us if you finish at the top of the class, you get to pick your own duty station. So I was determined. I mean, I studied, I understood supply and logistics, I understood all the intricacies of logistical stuff. Even as an 18-year-old, I understand because I had a good memory, and if I read it, I memorized it. So when they announced the class standards and they said I was number one in the class, the only thing I thought about is, ooh, I get to pick where I want to go. And since I was stationed in Southern California, I was at Camp Pendleton, as you mentioned, and specifically I was at Camp Del Mar, which is above Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
And I wanted to go to the main part of the base. They called it main side, where the PX was, the bowling alley, and all these other things that, you know, because I was in a remote area. And I said, well, I want to go to main side. So they abided and sent me to main side, and I went to work at the 1st Marine Division headquarters. And when I was at 1st Marine Division headquarters, I worked for a Black African-American Master Gunnery Sergeant. And I was in awe because here I was literally a young private first class. I may have been promoted to Lance Corporal by then, but I was a very junior enlisted. And I'm working for a very senior guy that had all these stripes and all these ribbons and badges. And he really took a personal interest in me because of my memory. I've always had a good memory, so I can recall to him what units were training where on the base. He didn't have to go to a file. There were no computers then. But I was his walking, talking computer. So I was on his hip for a long time. And unfortunately, back then, young Marines didn't get orders by name. You got orders by what they call QSN or quota serial number. I'll set it up for you. Washington, D.C. would send the commanding general at Camp Pendleton a message saying, I need three larger stations to go to Okinawa, Japan. And then the company gunnery sergeant had the power to say, you, and you, pack your bags. And I was one of those yous. So I got orders to Okinawa, Japan. So I only worked for the master gunny for, I want to say, maybe 6 months. But I tell you what, it was the best 6 months I had early on in my career. I felt privileged. I'm working at the division headquarters. And division was the highest level of headquarters in the Marine Division. Division headquarters, regimental, battalion, company. I was at division, so we were above everybody. It felt good to start off at the top. But what the Master Gunny did for me, Master Gunny Abrams, is I impressed him so much that he called his buddy in Okinawa, Japan, and says, I got one of my kids coming over to you. Grab him off the airplane and have him work for you. And Gunnery Sergeant Bennett did that. So I went from 1st Marine Division headquarters to 3rd Marine Division headquarters. And I worked for Gunny Bennett, who ended up being promoted to Sergeant Major. And when I finished my 1 year tour there, I got orders to the 2nd Marine Division. So Gunny Bennett called up Master Gunnery Sergeant Tarwater, said, I got this young, I'm a corporal now. He said, I got this young corporal. You got to tap his brain because he knows all about divisions and movements and all that. So when I got to Camp Lejeune in 79, I got pulled off the Joint Reception Center to work at 2nd Marine Division headquarters. So in the span of less than 2 years, I worked at all three active. There were four divisions. Three were active. One is the reserve, 4th Division. But I worked for all three divisions in the General's Office of Logistics in just under 3 years in the Marine Corps. And that's kind of unprecedented.
You were barely 20 years old, 21.
I was 20 when I reported to the 2nd Marine Division. I turned 21 that September. And that January, I got promoted to sergeant. So I was a sergeant at 21 years old. And that was a young looking sergeant. But I like to think I earned those three stripes. Very good.
So when you were career military, you were at 25 years?
25 years on active duty.
Okay. And then what was your career afterwards? And I'm going to talk about the Montfort Marine Association in a minute, because I know that's more of an avocation than a vocation.
Yes, and we'll go back to that, because that started really with that first Master Gunnery I mentioned.
Right,
but after I retired from the Marine Corps, I was fortunate enough to go to college while I was in the Marine Corps, and I graduated from Park University. It was Park College. It turned into a university I think 6 months after I graduated.
Was that tech in Texas?
No, Park University is in Parkland, Missouri.
Missouri, okay.
But it has a lot of satellite office college campuses, I think 42 at the time, that kind of catered to the military. And I attended one of those in Beaufort. So when I graduated from college with a degree, undergrad degree in operational management, and I worked in logistics for most of my 25 years. So I knew operational management. Now I had a college degree that says, you know, the college things I know it enough to graduate. And I thought that's where I was going to work. I wanted to work at a huge logistical warehouse like an Amazon now, where you got a million square foot restaurant and their warehouse, and they're run by teams, and those teams have team leaders, and those team leaders are responsible for their portion of that million square foot facility to get goods and services in and out. And I spent a lot of time packing, you know, ships, planes, and trucks. And I thought, wow, everything's under one roof. I could manage that team. So that's what I wanted to do. But I was convinced by the time I was retiring to seek another field. And I didn't understand why, but I had two ladies, two women. One was the equal opportunity officer for the civilian side of the house. I was equal opportunity for the military side of the house. And the other was my transition lady. And they both sat me down and said, Joe, have you ever thought about a career in human resources? And I said, no, I have not. I'm not trained for it. But they told me that you have a good memory, so you understand policies. And we know you interact with people good. And that combination kind of makes you uniquely qualified. So they really pushed me to redo my resume and focus on my managing of people instead of things. And AmeriGas Propane had an opening for literally an entry-level HR person. I mean, I couldn't start off any lower than I did. But they kind of convinced me that I should work in HR. So I worked for AmeriGas Propane, the largest propane distributor in the country. And here I am again at the headquarters. So I'm at their corporate headquarters in King of Prussia. And within 90 days of me being hired, I was being interviewed for a regional HR manager position. So I moved up pretty fast there. And even though I had opportunities to move up faster if I wanted to relocate, after 25 years in the Marine Corps, I was happy where I was. I was close to my mom. I was close to my brother and his kids. I'm like, I think I'm gonna make this my home. So if promotions come and they're not right here, then I wouldn't accept them. And I didn't. So I stayed with AmeriGas Propane for 18 years, and I retired just over 4 years ago.
Okay. All right. That's quite a career. So let's talk about the Moffett Port Marine Association. I know you're deeply committed to the legacy of the Moffett Porters. How'd you get involved with the Moffett Port Marine Association?
Okay, we're going to go back to my first duty station and that first Master Gunnery Sergeant Abram. When he found out that because I asked a lot of questions, and I think he liked that because I think my questions were relevant. When I left to go to Japan in February of 1978, he gave me a book that had only been published 2 years earlier called Blacks in the Marine Corps. That was his personal book. And he says, Geeter, I think, because he called me by my last name, he could do that. He says, Geeter, I think you'd be interested in this book. Why don't you take it? I said, do I need to give it back to you? He says, no, because I may never see you again if you go to Japan. So I took that book with me on the plane, and the plane ride was about 15 hours. And I read the book, and I read the book, and I read the book again. And by the time I landed in Japan, I pretty much had that book memorized. And so I started teaching that history to other Marines, even though, granted, I'm 19 years old. But I'm talking to other folks about the history of Blacks in the Marine Corps. And I got to be honest, a lot of times people didn't believe me at first because they say, how do you know all this? You're too young. You haven't been around. But I think they were more embarrassed that they didn't know.
Right.
So I started teaching the history, and I did not know that I could be part of the association until 9 years later when I'm stationed in my hometown of Chicago as a canvassing recruiter for the Marine Corps. And they had a chapter there, the Chicago chapter. It's one of the oldest chapters. It's chapter number 3. And I started going to the clubhouse mainly after work to have a beer or just to hang out. And some of the older guys, the Moffett Port Marines, kind of gravitated to me, and I gravitated to them. And they said, why aren't you a member of the association? And I said, I didn't know I could be a member. I thought you had to be a Moffett Porter. He says, no, it was like that in the very beginning when the association started in 1965. But now it's open to anybody in the military. We went to as a member of the Chicago chapter. So I joined the Chicago chapter and just did minimum member work because I was an active duty Marine recruiter. I had a full-time job. But when I left Chicago and went to San Diego, Well, first I went overseas for, I think, the third tour. And then I came back and went to San Diego. And San Diego had a chapter there, chapter 12. So I got really involved in that chapter. They really, because I'm a gunnery sergeant now. I'm head of logistics at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. So I can get them things on the base. You know, if they needed tents or chairs or tables, you know, I'm a logistician. I can get you anything we have. So they had that national convention there in 1992. And I got a chance to meet all these heroes that I only read about in that book. And particularly the founder, Brooks Gray, Master Gunnery Sergeant Brooks Gray. I knew the name. I knew what his history was as far as being the first national leader of Moffett Point Marine Association. And Brooks kind of took me under his wing. So I've been a very fortunate person, whereas these older people have always taken me underneath their wing and kind of guided me the right way. So I got more involved in 92 there, and then I went overseas again, excuse me, for my fourth tour. And then when I came back to Beaufort, they had a chapter there. And they really sought me out then. I'm sitting in my office, and the president of the chapter really comes into my office and something like, I heard you was here. We want you to be part of Beaufort. And I was so focused on doing other things, I resisted a little bit. But Elijah Abram, who also was serving as the national vice president, he didn't let up. So he said, no, we really want you here. So I joined his chapter, and Elijah Abram, and I give him a lot of credit because he gave me a lot of responsibility with the Beaufort chapter, first as the historian, and second as the special projects officer. So in 1999, our national convention was going to be at Parris Island. So that means, I mean, our spring council was going to be at Parris Island. So as national vice president, he talked to the president about me and says, I got this master sergeant at the time, Geeter, that's a good planner. And I think he can plan our spring council for 1999, which I did. You know, it went down as probably the most successful spring council in our history. I mean, it was like a day and a half longer than any other one. All the heroes that I read about in the book were there. I was the master of ceremonies at the banquet, and it was quite the moment for me because I looked out in the audience, and all these heroes that I read about and kind of met in passing were right in front of me. And after that meeting, even before that meeting, Brooks Gray really took a personal interest in me, and we talked almost every week on a Sunday, where he told me what I need to do to make the Beaufort chapter successful. And I listened to him, and I did almost everything, if not everything he told me to do. And the Beaufort chapter really came on the map. As a matter of fact, that chapter spawned five national officers from one little chapter in Beaufort, South Carolina. So when I left the Beaufort chapter, I came to Philadelphia area where I retired. And of all places, that's where the first chapter is. So I got lucky in four of my duty stations, one, two, three, four, three of my duty stations. And in my retirement, there was a chapter there. So by the time I got to Philly, I had a pretty decent reputation. And before I knew it, I was appointed national quartermaster because they knew I can sell things. And I made quite a bit of money for the association. And I came to attention of the then national president, who asked me, talked to me about running as his vice president. And I was honored, but I didn't really want that level of responsibility. National vice president, and I thought of myself still as a rookie member, even though at this time, this is 2003, I had been in association for 16 years. But people convinced me it was time to seek a higher national office, and I did. So I served as national vice president for one term, 2003 to 2005. And then I was convinced by all these Moffett pointers, and now that I've known for 10 to 15 years, they said, maybe, just maybe, you're ready to run for national president. I wasn't. As a matter of fact, I even made a public statement in April that I would not seek the office because I think the national president was getting kind of antsy, thinking I'm trying to take his job.
You made one of those Lyndon Baines Johnson statements? Lyndon Baines Johnson statement, nominated, I will not run.
Oh, yeah, well, 1968, yeah. After Kuwait, after the Battle of Khe Sanh,
right.
I would not seek or accept the nomination of my party. Yeah, right. I remember that speech very well. And I was determined not to do it. But when we got down to Camp Lejeune for the dedication of the Brooks Gray Memorial or Academic Building, because Brooks had died in 2000, so they named the building after him. And Brooks, again, was the founder and my absolute personal hero and mentor. Well, now I'm approached by some of Brooks' friends and my opponents that I knew that really, really encouraged me to run. And I was at a crossroads because I'd already made the statement that I would not seek the national presidency. So I did what only I could do at the time. I went to go visit Sergeant Major Huff's son. A lot of people know the name Sergeant Major Huff. He was one of the first six black drill instructors, the first sergeant major, the first black Marine to retire in 30 years, and just a legend in himself. Well, his son has been a friend of mine. Well, he's been a friend now over 40 years. So I went out and talked to him about it, and his mother had recently died. And I said, what do you think I should do, big brother? And he told me during the course of maybe having a sip of something, he said, you know, mama, and we called her mother. I called her mother, too. She was like a mother to me. She was my first Marple Point mother. And he looked at me and says, Joe, mom will want you to run. And so I had to make the difficult phone call to the existing president to tell him, pretty much, I'm coming after your job. You know, I was man enough to pick up the phone and tell him directly. And he was a little resistant at first. But when we got to convention 2005 and the stars lined up again, the convention was in my hometown of Chicago. And although I didn't politic for the job, I gave not one campaign speech. I wrote not one letter, but the members knew me. They knew I was a hard worker. And I think the president realized that too. So on the first day of the convention, convention is normally 4 days. First day is the welcoming. The last day is the banquet and the election of officers. But on the first day of the convention, he conceded the election to me the first day. It shocked me because I'm sitting on the dais, you know, with him, addressing the main body and the auxiliary. So I'm looking out at a couple hundred people in the audience, and it hit me all at once that he is conceding the election. And it took me back to 1992 when I met Brooks Gray, and he told me his words, one day, young man, you're going to run this association. And I thought he was crazy because I was a gunnery sergeant. I was still an active duty. They're like, Brooks, what are you talking about? He says, I see it in you. One day, you're going to run this association. So when he, when the president at the time, Nathaniel James, conceded the election on the first day of convention, and I don't mind saying this in public, the first time I cried in public, I cried because I thought about Brooks Gray, I thought about everything that I've done up to that point, and then I finally realized, you know, it's just my time, and I don't, you know, God kind of set me down that path. I didn't seek any of this, but it kind of just, everything just lined up. So I served 2 years as national president from 2005 to 2009.
Okay. So I'm told that you were instrumental in seeking the Congressional Gold Medal for the Montauk Point Marines. What inspired you to do that? And tell me about the process.
What inspired me was easy. In 2006, I'm national president. I'm sitting at home. I'm watching TV. And I think it was a football game. And then President Bush came on and was awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to the Tuskegee Airmen.
Okay.
And not 5 minutes after that, I'm still sitting there, my phone rings. And it's original Marple Pointer, Rudy Carter. And Rudy, you got to know, was a huge advocate of the Marple
Pointer. He was insanely committed, just passionately committed to getting his story out. So every time the Tuskegee Airmen or the Buffalo Soldiers or somebody else did something, he said, what about us? So when Rudy called me that day, he says, Mr. President, he called me Mr. President because I was, and he says, the Tuskegee Airmen just got the gold medal. I says, Rudy, I am watching the same thing you're watching. And he asked me, he says, what are you going to do about it? I'm like, what am I going to do about the Tuskegee Airmen? He says, no, what are you going to do about the Marple Pointers? I said, Rudy, I'm going to get you the Congressional Gold Medal. It was a blind promise to a Marple Pointer. And then the next day, I kind of realized what I did. I'm like, okay, how are you going to do this? So I started going down to D.C. just on my own, walking through the halls of Congress, the Rayburn Building, the Congressional Black Caucus, and talking to anybody that would listen to me. And evidently, I wasn't doing it right. Because when we got to the 2007 convention in Jacksonville, Florida, as national president, I always get a chance to meet, you know, the local politicians and people like that. And one of those politicians was a Florida state senator. His name was Anthony Tony Hill. So I had some one-on-one with Senator Hill on our free day, which is normally Thursday. It's a chapter event night during the convention. So he asked me, he says, what are your aspirations for the National Marple Point Marine Association? And I said, well, I have three goals. One, I want to get a commemorative stamp for the Marple Pointers. I thought that would be good to do that. Number two, I wanted to make sure the buildings that were left on Marple Point from World War II were preserved and maybe recognized in the National Register of Historical Places. I said, and third, three, I said, I've been talking about the Congressional Gold Medal. I've been going down to Congress to talk to people that would listen to me about it. And he thought I meant the Congressional Medal of Honor. And that's often confused in the media and the press. And I explained to him the Congressional Gold Medal when it was founded. And I think George Washington was the first recipient. And yep. I said, the Tuskegee Airmen got it. I think I can get it from them. So then he asked me again, well, how are you going to do it? And when I was explaining to him how I was doing it, he looked me dead in my face and said, you're doing it wrong. I said, yes, sir. Please tell me how I could do it right. He said, if you want to get any legislation through Congress, and this does require congressional legislation, you have to get the support of the Congressional Black Caucus. I says, okay, I'm listening. And he says, I know a member of that U.S. Congresswoman, Corrine Brown, who was supposed to be at the convention, but as a congresswoman, she couldn't make it. So Tony Anthony Hill, I can call him Tony now, it's been 17 years, was her representative. He said, if I can talk to Representative Brown and get you a few minutes in front of the military brain trust, it's a portion of the Congressional Black Caucus, would you be willing to go down there and address them? And I said, of course I would. So this was in July of 2007. On September 27, 2007, he got me what we thought was 15 minutes to talk to the military brain trust of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I won't get into all the details on how the communications got messed up. And I'm on my way to DC and they told me they didn't have time for me on the agenda. And I had just taken off from work and I did all this. So I called Senator Hill and explained the situation to him. He says, where are you? I said, well, I'm in Maryland. I just crossed the 109 mile marker. I just got into Maryland and I pulled over to call him. He says, stay there. And 15 minutes he called me. He says, you're on the agenda. So I imagine he called Corrine Brown, U.S. Representative Corrine Brown, and says, hey, this guy is coming up at my request. And your legislative aide is telling him that he's not on the agenda. And then he called me back and says, Joe, you're on the agenda. You got your 15 minutes. So I continued on down to D.C. for the Congressional Black Caucus. And when I got in there, I was in awe again. Here I am looking at Elijah Cummings. I'm looking at Maxine Waters. I'm looking at Charles Randall. I'm looking at Stanford Bishop. I mean, all these Black politicians that I, you know, see on TV and kind of knew about. Now that they're literally sitting in front of me when I'm talking. And then Senator Hill was sitting dead row center on the first row in front of me. And so I started my presentation and I realized my 15 minutes was coming up real soon. But I piqued the interest of some of the people there. And Representative Corrine Brown, who was sitting right to my left at the head of the dais, because it was her committee, she looked at me and she said, who did you bring with you? Because she saw some people in the audience that were dressed like I was in a Muffle Point cover, and we had our jackets on and ties and all that. And she said, who did you bring with me? I said, ma'am, as a matter of fact, I brought four of the original Muffle Pointers with me, because while I can talk about them, they are the real deal. She stopped the meeting. She says, have each one of them come up here. We're going to give all of them 5 minutes each. And so one by one, they paraded to the mic and told briefly their story. And I had brought literally a suitcase full of handouts. They gave me a table to pass out stuff. By the time we finished talking, every piece of paper on that table was gone. Every piece of paper. They took everything. Because many of these folks, to include members of the Tuskegee Airmen, the Buffalo Soldiers, the Triple Nickels, all these other African-American groups were part of this military brain trust, but the Muffle Pointers weren't included because they never heard of us.
Right.
So this is the first time many of them heard of us. And then when they concluded and everybody's milling around, U.S. Representative Brown came up to me and she says, she was impressed with the presentation. She says, who do you have in Congress to sponsor this legislation? I says, nobody, ma'am. She says, well, you got somebody now. You don't talk to anybody else. She recognized the importance of what was happening, and she wanted it to be her baby. And it was. And I tell you what, the relationship that we developed over those, the 111th, 112th Congress, I still talk to her. She called me last week just to check on me. She's not in Congress now for a lot of reasons, but she still checks on me this day. Because she's a fighter. I found that out early. Because when I got discouraged, because I thought, let me back up a little bit. In order to get a bill through the U.S. House of Representatives, we know it has 435 members. And the magic number is 218. But in order to get a congressional gold medal, you need a supermajority. So instead of 218, you need 290. So you got to get signatures first as sponsors and co-sponsors. So I worked real hard to get about 80 or 90 signatures. I thought I was doing good. But then the midterm elections came up in 2010. And according to the words of then President Barack Obama, the Democrats took a shellacking.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, out of the 70 or 80 names I had at the time, I think 20 of them did not get office anymore. I said, well, I could start with 50. That's good. And then Representative Brown says, no, sir, you start with zero. When a new Congress comes in, the slate is wiped clean. Any bill pending is not pending anymore. You got to start over. So right. I started to get discouraged because it took me literally 2 years to get what I had done. And just because of election, now I got to start over. And she says, Joe, she was calling me Joe now. She says, Joe, you hang in there. I'm going to be here with you. I got reelected, so I'm going to be here. And she hung in there with me. And the next 2 years were tough, but more and more people got used to seeing me in Congress. They got used to seeing the guy I traveled with, original Moffat Pointer, Colonel Carpenter. And whereas they was running from me in 2007, 2008, 2010 and 2011, they were inviting me in their office and, hey, Joe, we got 5 minutes. Can you come in here and give us a background on Moffat Point? And it's just amazing the transformation of the acceptance that the Moffat Point Marines and I received on Capitol Hill. And then the Commandant of the Marine Corps found out I was doing, General Amos. And during a ceremony, he kind of called me in his office. I'm like, the Commandant of the Marine Corps wants to talk to me? And he had heard that I was lobbying on Capitol Hill. And he says something to the fact that, you know, I hear you're lobbying in my area. Who's helping you? I said, sir, nobody's helping me. I just me and Lieutenant Colonel Carpenter. And he looked at me and said, don't you know I have a lobbying team in the United States Capitol? And me being me, I'm retired now. I know they can't hang me anymore. I said, sir, I've never seen them. And he called in a one-star general. I think the general was the head of the lobbying team for the Marine Corps in the U.S. Congress. And he introduced me to the general. And he really told the general, and it was fascinating to me. He says it was like a Jimmy Hoffa moment. Give this man what he wants. And the general was saying, what do you need? What can I do for you? So he took me to the Capitol. And we went down maybe two or three stories underground. It's a lot more underground than people think in the U.S. Capitol. And I walk in the office, and there's about 12 Marines there. I'm like, where have y'all been for 4 years? I've been walking to this lobby upstairs. But now I had the full force of the Commandant and the lobbying team. And from that day, I'm trying to remember the day. That was in August of 2011, because the Commandant hosted the Congressional Black Caucus at a breakfast, I believe, at his house in D.C. to try to sell it. You know, he's very interested. He's all the way behind me now. So that was in August of 2011. So the Commandant held a special parade at the Marine Corps Barracks at 8th and I for just the Moffat Pointers. He paid for all of them. I think we had about 130 living Moffat Pointers. And that kind of propelled us through Congress, and his office coordinated with the White House to get Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, just to sign a letter of support, because the Congressional Gold Medal comes for Congress. That's why it's called the Congressional Gold Medal. The president can award the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now, these are equal awards. They're both the highest awards that a civilian can receive on behalf of the United States government. But the Congressional Gold Medal has to go through both houses of Congress. Then the president signs into law. So right. First, it's got to go to the floor. First, we got to get that vote. First, we got to get that magical 290 number.
So and does the Senate also require 2/3?
Yes, it does. Okay. Yes, it does. But by the time it got through Congress, so and what, I 60, raced home.
67, I think, right?
Pardon me?
I think the magic number in the Senate is 67.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep, 2/3, a supermajority. So by the time it came to the floor, I'm watching it at home on C-SPAN, and it was electronic voting. It was a 5-minute electronic vote. So I'm thinking about it. This is October 25th, I believe, 2011. And I'm like, I've been at this for 4 years. I spent a lot of my own money, took a lot of my vacation days, wore out my poor little 2002 Jeep going back and forth to DC, and everything came down to a 5-minute vote. So when they put the board up, the voting board, you get to see the voting as they tell. It's real time.
Right.
So you see the yay, nay, and abstain. And I'm watching it. We got 50 yes, no no's, 60 yes, no no's, 100 yes, no no's. I'm getting excited. And then all of a sudden, somebody voted no. And I'm on the phone with the national president thinking I got some kind of power. I'm like, that person would never seek office again. And then 5 minutes later, the no switched to a yes. So the only thing I can conclude is, number one, they pushed the wrong button. Or number two, they saw this was going to overwhelmingly pass. And they didn't want to be the only knucklehead to vote against.
They wanted to be on the right side of history.
Yeah, they wanted to be on the right side of history, correct. So at the end of voting, the final vote was 422-0. It was the most bipartisan piece of legislation from the, they called it, and they called a lot of Congress, the do-nothing Congress. But this they all agreed on. But now it's got to go to the Senate. And we had a powerful sponsor of the Senate, Senator Kate Hagan out of North Carolina. She took a personal interest in it because Maple Point is in North Carolina.
Right.
So she convinced them, instead of going through a roll call vote or a board vote, they voted by affirmation. By decree. So all those in favor, and then they recorded as a supermajority, 67-0. So now the House has passed it, the Senate, because U.S. Representative Corrine Brown told me, Joe, I'm going to get this legislation passed by my birthday. Her birthday is Veterans Day. It came to the floor of the Senate, on November 9th. And then on November 23rd, we thought we was going to have a great ceremony in the White House, and President Obama was going to take that pen in his left hand and sign the legislation, but he was out the country. So if you're out the country and bills land on the president's desk, I believe you have 10 days when the president returns to sign it, or else it's a hip pocket veto. So when he got back from, I believe he was in Australia, needless to say, a lot of bills had piled up. So he unceremoniously signed the bill. The bill is now public law 112-59 without any of us being there. And to this day, I regret that, because I wanted to have that aha moment for these Maple Pointers gathered around their resolute desk and have that moment.
But better that than having to start all over again.
Yeah, I bet. Again, that helped out.
But I fully realized
when people were, patting me on the back that, hey, your work is done, you did it, I knew that the work had just started.
Right.
Now we got to find 20,000 families, and there's no record anywhere of all 20,000 of these Marines.
So that's the kind of this good segue to where I was going to go. So why are there no records for the Marines? I know that in the Army, some of the records were burned in a fire. What happened?
Well, that's just the Army. The fire of 1973 really did not affect the Marine Corps. As a matter of fact, only about maybe 12 Marine Corps records were burned because they happened to be in transit the day of that two-day fire. It affected the Army greatly, but it didn't affect the Marine Corps. The reason the Marine Corps doesn't have a record is pretty obvious to me. Number one, it was 80 years ago. Let's just say they had a record from 1942. What's the chance of anybody living in the same house or even living? So they just don't. They have muster rolls of names, but no contact records. So what we had to do is, for the Congressional Gold Medal, the first one, is send out PSAs, public service announcements, to about 400 news agencies across the country. And that generated the response. I personally conversed with 800 families between January and April of 2012. And of those 800 families, almost half of them had a living Maple Pointer. So the Pentagon, now the Pentagon kind of took over my work. I had to send all my records down to the Pentagon. That was a sad day. But now they took the lead on my work. And the team lead for that called me because they were overwhelmed with it. And I said, well, ma'am, I'm sorry, you called the wrong person, because I did this by myself with a full-time job. So you tell them you got a staff of six in the Pentagon and it's too much work. But they narrowed it down to 400 slots for living Maple Pointers. And we almost met that. I think we had about 367 living Maple Pointers there. And then they made exceptions for a few of the families who were really dogging them, saying, I want to be there. But it wasn't for the families. It was for the original Maple Pointers. So all said and done, we had about 400 there.
So about how many Maple Pointers are living now? I know it's...
Very good question. And
decade later.
Yeah, well, we just adjusted our numbers. If you go by the VA, we know that 16 million Americans fought in World War II. 16 million. Black, white, women, everybody. The mortality numbers and what they get from the VA is less than 1% of those are living. It was 2% 2 years ago. It's less than 1%. So if I apply those same numbers to the Maple Pointers, and these are Black men who inherently have medical conditions that kill them faster than other people, let's call the numbers what they are, our best estimate is between 250 and 300 living Maple Pointers today in 2024.
Okay. So there's no one set process for finding them. You do PSAs a lot and a lot of word of mouth. But what's the verification process to confirm if someone says, oh, you know, my father was a mantra pointer,
Very
and
good.
I know you've had some situations where people were kind of appropriating and
Yes.
pretending that they had relatives who were mantra and they were not. So what's the process you use for
And
verifying?
that's from day one. You put it politely, because some folks tried to claim they were Marines because it was the Congressional Gold Medal. So the president then, and coincidentally the president now, Dr. James T. Eberhardt, set up the initial process along with a few others to say, how are we going to verify it? And the number one document is the discharge. So we wanted to make sure we were uniform, because some people are trying to submit newspaper articles, funeral programs, pictures in uniform, which really says something but doesn't. So we agreed the only document we would accept would be the discharge. And back then, there was no DD-214 as you know it now, but the same data on the current DD-214, which came into existence in 1950, was printed on the back of the discharge. So we still had the same data. So he set up our spreadsheet to extrapolate that data, put it on a spreadsheet. So now, say family calls me today. I think my dad's a mafia pointer. I ask for the discharge. If they don't have it, I guide them on how to fill out the standard form 180 to get a copy from National Personal Records Center. Once they get that, I do the spreadsheet. I do the verification with the family and through the discharge, and I submit it to the national president, who is the singular approving authority. That way we kind of keep it that, you know, one person looks at it. In the last 2 years, I've submitted well over 200 requests for gold medals. Not one was disapproved. So if you can get past me, well, we can get past the president.
So if someone out there in the listening audience knows of a mantra pointer, or they think they're related to one, who should they contact? Should contact the mantrapointmarines.org? Is that?
That's the number one place.
Mantrapointmarines.org. Okay.
Yeah. If they send an email there, it goes to what we call info@mantrapointers. It goes to the webmaster, Master Memory Sergeant Gilbert Taylor. He will look at it and forward that email to me, and I take it from there.
Okay. So this is, so each congressional gold medal, thanks to the president before last, now cost $160. So the Mafra Port Marine Association conducts annual award ceremonies around the country and gives the medals to the families at no cost. How are the medals and award ceremonies funded?
They're funded individually by the chapters. So the national president has laid down that if this in your chapter area, say somebody in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia chapter is responsible for it. If I'm a regional vice president and the family is 100 miles away from the chapter, then the national will provide for that medal.
But it's not like you all have a source of income, a regular source of income. So how does the money get to the chapters to fund?
Very good, very good. Yeah. And I can speak for Philadelphia, because I'm also the president of the Philadelphia chapter. And when I go around my AO or my area of operations and I give presentations, many times they offer to pay me an honorarium. Every time I've denied it, because I don't want to associate myself with getting one penny for this passionate work I do. But I've learned since the metal price has quadrupled from $40 to $160, we need streams of revenue to cover that. So I've had to do the hard ass and saying, I don't take an honorarium, but if you want to donate to our chapter, we're a 501c3, and we have a tax ID or EIN, employee identification number, then you could take a tax deduction on it. Since that time, I'm talking about just since November, we've collected in Philadelphia, I think, $6,500. Okay. And that's pretty good. And we also run a campaign where the VA, we partner with the VA here, Rita Chappelle. I love the VA, and they've been a great partner. They develop a donation sheet. So when I do my mailings, I put the donation sheet in there. It's a piece of paper, just one little piece of paper. But through that one little piece of paper, we've generated another, what's five times 160, $800. Because people say, hey, I want to sponsor a medal. And the medal is 160. Our ceremony, we've kind of costed that out too. To do one family in Philadelphia, to give them the full ceremony that we give them, is about $400 or $500. Because in Philadelphia, what we do is I look at the discharge and find other medals that they probably earned and never got. For instance, if you had a mafia point asserted in the Pacific, there's three medals they get: the American Campaign Medal, the Asiatic Pacific Medal, and the World War II Victory Medal. Now, these medals could be bought online, but it's more special when you present them at the ceremony. So when I go down to Capitol June in April, I can buy those medals on base for $9 or $10. If I go online, they're $27. So right. I stack up on the medals. So the families, most of the time, they don't know they're getting the extra medals. So we conduct a very formal ceremony. I have what I call my Congressional Gold Medal ceremony team. And my daughter's part of that. And she actually reads the letter from President Barack Obama during the ceremony. And then my vice president, the chapter vice president, reads the certificate of service. And then I usually have a dignitary there. I've had three Congress men, they're all men, Brendan Boyle, Dwight Evans, and Senator Vincent Hughes, the husband of Shirley Ralph. He actually conducted a eight Congressional Gold Medal. We had eight families in there. It's the largest I've ever done. I've done a lot of ones, twos, threes, a few fours, but I never tried to do eight. Last year, we did eight at one time at the VA Center, and Senator Vincent Hughes officiated. And we're in contact now. He was so impressed with our ceremony because the VA provides the professional
book. That's the one I attended, I think.
I thought you attended one with Colonel Cummins.
I did, but that's a different one?
That's a different one. Yeah, I think we did three or four that day.
So the big national event takes place in August in Jacksonville, North Carolina?
It's going to be August 23rd. We've been lucky the last 3 years because it coincided with our national convention, which was held in Jacksonville. We're going to run into a problem next year, logistically, of all things, and how to do that. When we first did Moffettport Marine Day, President Everhart and then Vice President James Carr were the principal lobbyists to get the Senate to provide a resolution to claim August 26th Moffettport Marine Day. And the reason why it's August 26th, because on August 26th, 1942, is when Howard P. Perry from Charlotte, North Carolina, was the first one off the bus at Moffett Point Camp. So we have a Senate resolution declaring the Moffett Point Marine Day. And this was our 14th year doing it last year. Normally, we just celebrate the day. We had a ceremony. People were at the monument. We do have a monument that sits right outside what used to be called Moffett Point Camp. It's now called Camp Johnson. And we do commemorative ceremonies there. But then we started awarding the Congressional Gold Medal at the ceremonies, and it went over big. 2 years ago, we had 11 families receive the Congressional Gold Medal. But since then, we partnered with ABC-owned television stations to produce a 27-minute, 28-second docuseries.
It's a great piece.
Shown to 95% of the country last February. Right. So whenever they show it, my phone blows up. Mallory's phone blows up. So I know if I get five phone calls from Tulsa, Oklahoma, I say, well, they probably showed it in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So that has helped generate it. I wish I could put an exact number on there, but let's just say six or seven, maybe even 10 times the amount of inquiries we've gotten. So it keeps Mallory and I busy. One day last year, I think we did 11 in one day. You know, I can remember I did 11 in a year. We did it in one day. So we're picking up the pace. So while we're not actively, at least as an association, seeking out to find them, we're getting enough people to contact us to keep us busy. Rarely a day goes by, I don't talk to a family, start, finish the process of a gold medal. But even if I do one a day, that's 365 in a year. Yep. We've only awarded 3,000 with 17,000 to go. If you do the math, it's going to take us a long time.
Yes, yes. And it's a good thing your daughter and the next generation is involved as well.
And that's exactly right.
So if any of the listeners want to donate to help with the cause, who should they contact? Should they also go to MoffettPointMarines.org?
Yes, there's a donation page on there. And not only can they donate, if they can donate, of course, we'll take the money. They can target their money towards the scholarship. They can target it towards the museum. Or they can target it for general operating costs. But they can also purchase a commemorative brick. We built a $1.8 million monument in Jacksonville, North Carolina with $10 and $20 bills. We had no federal funding. The state of North Carolina did provide some funding, but it was mostly done with family members, association members. It's a beautiful, beautiful monument. And right now it conducts more reenlistments, promotions, and we do our national ceremony there. Last year, we did 55 families. This year, they cut us down. We only have 30 slots, and I'm looking at 20 folders at my feet right now. So we've only got 10 slots left for this year, and the cutoff is April 20th. So April 20th of this year, and I'm sure we're going to reach 30 by then, we will have the slate set for our ceremony August 23rd in Jacksonville, North Carolina. Make sure I got to say North Carolina, because one person actually booked a flight to Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes.
I feel so bad for them. But well, you got
when Mallie first told me, I was like, oh, can I get down? And I was looking up the fares to Jacksonville, Florida as well.
But somebody actually booked it, so at least you didn't book it. So
No.
So we're doing 30 this year, but we're also going to vote on convention 2025, and I could pretty much guarantee it's not going to be in Jacksonville 4 years in a row. Other chapters are chopping at the bit to hold convention because it's a lot of benefits for a chapter that holds a convention. Mostly exposure, the membership should go up, maybe the donations go up. So I understand. I've heard personally from three chapters already. So next year, and I'm just saying this, I'm not committing a convention. Let's say it's going to be, let's use Philly. That way nobody can say anything. Let's say it's in Philly. Now, if the convention's in Philly and it's in August, what are we going to do about the National Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony? Is it going to be in Jacksonville or will it go where the convention is? We don't know the answer to that right now. That's up to the national president, the National Executive Council. I have brought that up to them. I said, be prepared because I don't think members are going to want to go to two separate ceremonies in two separate geographical locations. So right. We got to understand that now before it's looking us in the face. But all I am now is an advisor. I got to remind folks, I'm not national president anymore. I stepped down from being a Northern Regional Vice President in August. So my job right now is to run the Philadelphia chapter, to be National Public Relations Officer, and to coordinate the Congressional Gold Medals. That sounds like a lot. It's only three jobs, but I had five or six 2 years ago. So it's a little bit less. But it still keeps me quite busy.
So obviously you've met some of the surviving pointers. Oh, yeah. Any that, can you think of a couple of one or two interesting stories that inspire you or intrigue you?
Every last one of them. I tell my friend rarely, and absolute rarely, a day goes by without me talking to one of my proponents. Many times it's four, five, six. Sometimes it's a lot. It's just that's how the phone rings. But what amazes me most about these men, and of course they're all men, is their resiliency after all these years. The ones that we have living now, and I can use Philadelphia as an example. I've got 11 living MAPA pointers in and around Philly or that I look after. I got Alan Williams down in West Palm Beach, Florida, and I've got a couple of other ones that are not here, but they're not near a chapter, so I kind of take them underneath my wing. My baby, the youngest one, turned 95 on February 14th. That was his birthday. My oldest one would turn 100. That's Master Gunnery Sergeant Carol Braxton. He would turn 100 on July 16th. So all those 11 that we have, they're between 95 and 100 years old. But most of them that are still alive can still stand up to an interview. And just during February, we partnered with El Dorado Films. I'm working on a graphic novel right now. I've been assisting authoring a graphic novel book that's due to the publisher in September. But during the filming to develop these composite characters or these characters for the book, the Daniel Burnett, I may say his name wrong. This is Daniel from El Dorado Films. He did a lot of filming. He thought he was just filming, you know, B-roll for references. But when he got back to home and started looking at all the film he had, he said, there's a story in each one of them. So from those five or six MAPA pointers they interviewed for the graphic novel, every last one of them has a short video on them. And during the month of February, we released four of those, one a week of those, and I put them on social media. They're available if you Google MAPA Point, IMDb or something. I forgot, but
yep, that's it's IMDb. Point, yep,
IMDb. If you Google that and put MAPA Point next to it, you will see all those videos. The shortest one is probably 7 or 8 minutes long. The longest one that's been released is probably 22 minutes long. But we still got one more to release on Master Gunnery Braxton because he has the best stories possible. And as much as they try to edit it down, it's still 52 minutes. but Master Gunnery Braxton has a great story because he was one of the MAPA Point Marines, one of the first to see actual battle in the Pacific. Because these Marines, even though they trained two combat units, the 51st and the 52nd Defense Battalion, none of them deployed to a hotspot. The companies that deployed were ammunition and depot companies. So on the 15th of June, 1944, some of these ammo and depot companies landed on the island of Saipan on the first wave. So normally, you know, the infantry goes in, secures the beach, and then the follow-on troops and the logistical supplies come in. But MAPA pointers landed on the first wave, and that was an opposed landing. So they were fighting, you know, from the beach. Unlike, you know, maybe Iwo Jima, where the Japanese let them land and then fired on them. So side by side, if a white Marine looked to his left and looked to his right during that battle, he may have found a Marfa Point Marine. Or if a Marine got killed to fill the line, a Marfa Point Marine may have filled the line. So this June, we're going to celebrate, the island of Saipan is going to celebrate 80 years since that invasion. And I'm so glad, and I hope he continues to live. Master Gunny Braxton was part of that invasion. So all of them have great stories. I mean, I visit with them regularly. I was with Sergeant Wilcox. He was my traveling partner for about 10 years. He's no longer able to travel, but his mind is still sharp. And I enjoy going to the senior facility, sitting with him, tapping his mind. And he is one of the individuals featured in the video. It's 17 minutes long. And his sons, he's got two sons. This is a Marfa Pointer. He got out of a boot camp, decided to go to college in Colorado to study architecture. But he was caught up during the Korean War, and he served over a year in combat. At some times, he was the commander of the platoon. His sons never knew that story. So now that they're still, the ones that are still living, I think they're compelled to tell their story for posterity and for their fellow comrades. So when he finished taping, his son, one of his sons came up to me. Now get this, this guy has two sons. One is an astrophysicist. He's a dean at the University of Wisconsin. The other one is a paleontologist. You know, he studies dinosaurs. Paleontologist. So this Marfa Point Marine from humble beginnings in Iowa generated two sons at the top of their game in their respective field. So Sergeant Wilcox means the world to me. When we were still going to regular meetings, he would get there. He would take a train, a bus, walk. And I told him, I said, if your son, one of his sons, David, if he gets you there, I will get you home. That way he doesn't have to sit here while you're at the meeting. And on those rides home, we had literally father-son talks. We got to know each other real good. And I don't know, you know, we're all going to go one day. But when Sergeant Wilcox's time is up, I don't know what I'm going to do, because my daughter loves him. The chapter loves him. We love all of our Marfa Pointer. But Sergeant Wilcox has that special, because he was an architect. And he worked under a world-renowned architect named Louis Kahn, K-H-A-N, Louis Kahn, who was building a parliamentary building for, I believe, Bangladesh. But Louis Kahn died prematurely, and nobody could understand his sketching or writing. So they called on Sergeant Wilcox to finish the project. And just like architectures throughout time, where Blacks couldn't hold a license, you apprentice for an architecture, they built a building. I'm not going to say anything, but Duke University, there's a Black person that did that, but never got credit for it.
Yeah.
So, but now in his twilight, one of my missions, and I told him this 10 or 12 years ago, my job is to get your story out. And since that time, he's had a front page, above the fold, color picture story in the Philadelphia Inquiry. They're rediscovering Louis Kahn's work, because as a great architect, you're not famous until years later when you die sometimes. And now they're looking at this guy's work, and it's incredible. And they're finding out a Black man was at his side during all this. So he's getting a certain bit of celebrityism, I guess. And he's loving it, because it just feels good. But when he told his story on film, his son told me, she says, Joe, I've never heard that story from Dad before. He never talked about it. But I'm glad he's in a position where he's comfortable and he's trusting. And, you know, when you're in a combat situation like that, you talk amongst yourself. You know, somebody said, I probably can't clean it up good enough for podcast, but he said, those who know. Those who don't, well, the heck with them. So the people that served in combat, especially extensive combat, like a year in Vietnam, most of them, they're starting to talk about it now. But anybody that had a World War II vet in their home, I'm not a gambler, but rarely do those men talk about their experiences. And I had three. My grandfather served with the 57th Ordnance Company, landed on Normandy, not on D-Day, probably about 8 or 9 days later, but fought in three battles, to include the Battle of the Bulge. My uncle was a Navy corpsman that served with the Marfa Point Marines in the Pacific during World War II. My father was a Navy pharmacist that served mostly on land in Northern California. And when the ships came in the Pacific, they took smaller boats out to meet the ships because it was all running short on medication. So my father was one of the ones that would administer medication to them as they made their way to San Francisco. I grew up with all three of these men. Not one conversation that I have with any of them about anything until after I came to the Marine Corps. My grandfather kind of told me a little bit, I mean a very little bit, as I was going overseas. He was more kind of like warning me because he didn't know if I was going to be in harm's way or not. And he told me not to volunteer for anything and keep your head down. And he didn't really talk about his experiences, but we talked about the military, and he was proud that I was a Marine. So most of these vets, they don't tell this story. And the Library of Congress has the Veterans Project, where you can go on film, you can submit documents, and they will develop your own page of your story. And I would encourage any listener to get their veteran that's living to tell their story. And even if you don't want to go through that process, and it's free, and if you contact them, they'll send you a package on how to do it and how to best do it. But even if you take your iPhone or your Joy phone, put it on a tripod and record Grandpa, it will be precious for your family. So we need to preserve this history while we still have some of these living, particularly World War II vets, still with us. The numbers used to be, we lost about 2,000 World War II vets a day 6 or 7 years ago. That number is down to about 125 a day, mainly because 98% of them are gone.
Right.
So
right.
If you have one in your family of any branch of service, I'm not talking about just Muffin Point Marines here, but any branch, their legacy needs to be preserved. And the best person to preserve that legacy is the person themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just a couple more questions as we wrap up this evening. So what do you think is the legacy of the Montfort Pointers?
They persevered through some difficult times. Montfort Point was no different than the United States of America. As a matter of fact, if you study history and study the social transition or growth of Americans, particularly with African Americans, the military was seemingly ahead. Jackie Robinson didn't break into baseball in 1947. Howard Perry got to Montfort Point in 1942. So we've been kind of ahead of it. Most of Montfort Pointers did not realize that they were the first Black Marines. As a matter of fact, many did not realize they were going to a segregated camp until they arrived. They thought they were going to Marine Corps Recruit Depot Perez Island or the Marine Corps Recruit Depot out of San Diego, California. They had no idea this was a separate but equal situation. But as the years have gone
in this
by,
case, it was separate and unequal.
Separate and unequal, yeah, because Mopple Point Camp was a...
It was just a swamp, wasn't it? They had to go
in
there
It was an
everything.
Old Civilian Conservation Corps camp from World War One. It was dilapidated buildings, no running water. So those first recruits that arrived literally had to build the camp before they could go through recruit training. I mean, what kind of perseverance is that? So those men that did it, and what I found out, and I'll say this quickly, I talked personally to 800 families, more than 800 families over a 90-day period. I was doing a lot of phone calls. What I found out was a couple of common threads. Number one, most of them married their high school or childhood sweetheart. Most of them at that time had been married for 50 or 60 years. Most of them had children that were highly educated. They were doctors and lawyers and politicians. And they may, although they didn't talk about their service, their family knew they was in the Marine Corps, that's for sure. But they really stressed education. And I remember, because after I heard these common threads, I would ask the Mapa Pointer, I said, so you still married? He goes, yeah, I'm still married. My wife's upstairs. I says, how long have you been married? And I can hear somebody on the extension, you better give them the right answer. So the wives and a lot of them were listening in on the phone because they wanted to make sure nobody was trying to take advantage of their husband. But
right.
Once I won them over and they knew I was there literally to help, I'm not from the government, but I'm here to help you get this gold medal. I could always remember every conversation. I got a good memory. And some stand out more than others. One of them we buried 2 weeks ago in General Albert Bryant. He could not get a commission in the Marine Corps because the Marine Corps wasn't making Black folks officers. So he got the Marine Corps, got in the Army, and in the Army Reserve, he rose up to Brigadier General. What strikes me about Albert Bryant is I had some people come to my house, literally sit in this chair or the chair before this, and we'll get all this mail. I was getting 40, 50, 60 pieces of mail a day. I was overwhelmed. So I needed help. So my friends would come over and help me. And one friend that opened up, I was downstairs working on the folders that we were building with her daughter. And she yelled at me from upstairs, Joe, come upstairs. You got to see this. And we opened up the envelope and it was for Albert Bryant. This guy was born on the Marine Corps birthday, November 10th, 1925, if I'm not mistaken. He made sergeant before he went to Iwo Jima. He was with the 8th Ammo Company, and I understand all the units and the companies, and if I was forced to pick one company, it would be 8th Ammo Company, because I got to know many of those members as I grew up in the Marple Pointer. Those were the members that landed on D-Day, February 19, 1945, on Iwo Jima. So despite what you may see in Saving Private Ryan and other films, we were there, and they were there. So that 8th Ammo Company holds a special place in my heart, and I got to finally meet General Bryant at the ceremony in November, on June 27, 2012. And we were in constant contact until about a year before he died. So I love some General Bryant, and I tell his story because and we just buried him, General Albert Bryant, Brigadier General. Google him. I think you'll be impressed with his resume.
So my last question is, you've had a chance to meet some of these brave soldiers. What lessons from their life stories can you share to inspire young African-Americans to embrace fear as opportunity so they can be their best selves? Yeah. Shout out to them.
And I know the word soldier is used for any person that's serving in the branch of the military, but Marines,
I apologize.
We got a picky here. So,
I apologize.
But what they left us, I think, is to persevere, to focus on your mission, focus on what you want to do in life, and don't let anybody discourage you. So these Marple Pointers were told, when they first got there, the drill instructors were coming to their, I wish they barracks, but they weren't barracks, they were huts. They came into their hut and said, we don't want you here. You're not going to be a Marine. We've never had Black Marine. So just leave. And nobody's going to come looking for you. And to a man, they stayed. They knew at some point, well, if they don't want me here doing it, it must be a good thing.
That's right.
And one of those Marines was Sergeant Major Huff, and he was a big guy. He was about 6'6", 6'7", and he from Gaston, Alabama. And he says, if anybody leaves, you have to go through me. So he says, I'm not going back to Gaston, Alabama. I came here with 25 cents in my pocket, and now I've got, three shirts just alike. I got an overcoat for the first time in my life, 3 meals a day. He says, I'm going to hold on to the Marine Corps like a bulldog to a bone. And I held on, baby. And he held on for 30 years. So persevere, stay with your mission, stay with your goals.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us tonight, for sharing these amazing stories. And I'm really grateful for the time you spent with me tonight.
I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it. Like I said, I'm like the Marple Pointer. I'm a persevere. I was under the weather and we had some scheduling conflicts, but we got it done and I appreciate it, Doc.
All right. To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I'd like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight I'll share a quote from American poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou. My mission in life is not merely to survive, but to thrive. And to do so with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style. See you for our next show on Wednesday, March the 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, New York City Podcast Network, and Spotify for Podcasters.